For some, the sea is not a place. It is a calling, a home away from home. If you find yourself drawn to the water, we can take you there. Imagine you, your friends, and family on a private yacht in the most beautiful places in the world, from the Bahamas or the Virgin Islands to Greece, Italy, Tahiti, and beyond. This is a yacht charter vacation with The Moorings, and it's easier than you think. Inquire today. Your next great vacation begins at moorings.com. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
And we are back, Crossover NBA Podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. The last podcast before NBA training camps opened up. Beck, training camps are scheduled for media day. I think it was you that said, like, end of August, early September, that September is the shortest month of the year. It really is. Like, it just kind of flew by.
As proof, I said that 5 minutes ago. That's how fast September goes by. I literally said that 5 minutes ago, and here we are. It's the last week of September or-ish, and media days are right around the corner. So, yeah, thanks, September. It was nice knowing you briefly. Here we go.
Yeah. All right. On this episode, we're going to get into the Robert Williams injury in Boston, what that means for the Celtics. Some news about collective bargaining. We could have a return to the 18-year-old age minimum, which would effectively make high school players in play in the next CBA. And the Lakers, one of the most interesting teams, as usual, going into camp. What did the Lakers do with the guard spot? They fortified their backcourt with Dennis Schroeder this past week. You've still got Russell Westbrook, Patrick Beverley. How is that all going to play out in Los Angeles? Beck, who do you got lined up for the Friday version of the Crossover Pod?
Yes, so the head of officiating, I can never remember his precise title because, of course, NBA titles are very long and cumbersome and full of unnecessary commas and weird capitalization. But Monty McCutcheon, head of NBA officiating, will be making his annual return to the pod to discuss rules changes, points of emphasis, random referee things. In fact, folks, if you hear this pod before, because I'm going to see him, in fact, on Thursday, there's a peek behind the curtain. If anyone's listening to this pod before then, and you want to hit me on Twitter at Howard Beck with questions for Monty McCutcheon, I might be able to pass some of those along.
All right. Well, we look forward to that on Friday. So, Howard, let's start with the breaking news on Tuesday, which is that Robert Williams III, the Celtics starting center, a annual candidate for Defensive Player of the Year, kind of backstopped what they did defensively last year. He is going to miss the next 4 to 6 weeks with a knee surgery, that same knee that he had operated on during the playoffs last year, before the start of the playoffs last year. The injury is expected to keep Robert Williams out during the preseason for training camp, but if all goes well, he will be back before the start, or before too long into the regular season. The positive is it's happening now and not happening at the start of the season. But it does leave the Celtics pretty thin on that front line. Danilo Gallinari already likely to be lost for most of, if not the entire season. The size in the front court is really limited at this point to Al Horford and Grant Williams. In terms of established players, you've got Luke Kornet there for deep in the weeds Celtics fans that know who Luke Kornet is and what he's doing on that roster. But, it's not a huge cause for concern yet, Beck, but I don't dismiss it as being nothing at this point.
It's not nothing because of his history and his recent history, right? Like all the games missed last season, all the concerns with his knee, even into the finals with health issues with Robert Williams III. And as critical as he is to their defensive schemes, remember, he was possibly the front runner for Defensive Player of the Year until he went down during the season, and that's when things kind of shifted to Marcus Smart. You know, and it is one of those things where everyone's trying to parse out, like, who should be more credited, who's more responsible for the Celtics' fantastic suffocating defense. Is it Williams? Is it Marcus Smart? Is it a combination of thereof and of this whole crew? He's important. Put it that way. He's important. Tweet from Matt Williams at the ESPN Stats and Research Department put this up when the news broke that Robert Williams III held opponents to 50.7% shooting at the rim, according to NBA Advanced Stats. That ranked fourth among players to defend 200 shots, trailing, as everyone would guess, Isaiah Hartenstein, Jaren Jackson Jr., and Rudy Gobert. Two of those people would have guessed. The third, they would not have. One of the nice pickups by the Knicks this summer in Hartenstein. Robert Williams is important. Okay, we know that. He's injury prone, and this is an issue for him and for the Celtics. But, I mean, listen, I did the quick and dirty math. If he's getting surgery, let's say by Friday, 4 weeks brings him back October 21st, he'd miss a game or two. If he's out 6 weeks, it's like 7 or 8 games, returning on November 4th. So it's not catastrophic in that regard. It just feels like if you're a Celtics fan, if you're the Celtics organization, it's, oh, man, you know, here we go again. And you would have liked to have gotten this taken care of earlier in the summer. I assume this was something that more recently occurred. This was not something they could have just opted to do back in July or August. I'm guessing that maybe there was something new found. I don't have those details. Maybe you do.
Yeah, I've got a little. It's just some discomfort I was told that has arisen over the last couple of weeks as Robert Williams has been ramping up for the start of the season. And my understanding is it was effectively, look, let's just get it taken care of right now, to your point, so that, you know, all he misses are maybe the first couple of weeks of the regular season. We can have him back for the duration of it. I mean, this is just more like speculation, but if I'm the Celtics, I give him the full 6 weeks. Remember, he came back from the last knee surgery pretty quickly. I think it was only a month that he took off, and he came back in the middle of that Brooklyn series, and really from the moment he came back, he was day-to-day. Like, he had to... He was in and out of the lineup, and you had to wonder if he had taken a little bit more time off, would he have been healthier for the stretch run? Robert Williams, history of lower leg injuries. I think you've got to give him as much time as humanly possible, but it's right, I think, to have him have this procedure now, and then, you know, hopefully it's not an issue during the regular season. What you have to think about, though, Howard, is the depth here. And is there a need in Boston to go out and sign someone else? Now, last week, I sat here, we did a little game of where should they land some of the veteran free agents that were out there. Dwight Howard was a name that was on our list, and I suggested back then that Dwight Howard would be a good fit in Boston. I believe it even stronger right now. I mean, Dwight Howard, 36, 37 years old, role player, only going to give you 15, 20 minutes per game, but he has done it as recently as 2020 on a championship level. He has accepted that he is not the Dwight Howard of old. He's not looking for touches, you know, that number in the double digits on the low post. And even with Robert Williams, one of the things the Celtics have needed has been some muscle on that front line. Dwight Howard can provide some muscle, at least in short spurts. So, look, we'll see what Brad Stevens decides to do here, but as long as Dwight Howard is available, I think he's a pretty good option for the Celtics.
I agree. I mean, listen, short term, if you had to get by with Grant Williams and Al Horford and more small ball and whatever, I think they'd probably be fine. I think the bigger question is, do you think you can count on Robert Williams III to make it through the whole season and into the playoffs? And are you looking for insurance, not just as a stopgap now, but actual, like, listen, we need the depth to get through the season. We want to make sure that Robert Williams III is at his best for what we hope is going to be another deep playoff run, right? If you're the Celtics, you're thinking finals or bust again. And so if that's the case, you got to, I would think, be, you know, thinking in those terms. They do have, from what I can gather, 12 guaranteed deals. So if you're going to sign Dwight, now you're cutting Luke Kornet, I guess, or you're cutting Sam Hauser. I mean, you're cutting somebody. Is that really that big of a concern? No. By the way, Noah Vonleh is on a training camp invite contract. So there's the other bit of depth there. We haven't seen him around the NBA in a while, I think. So maybe they feel like they've got it. But I agreed with you last week when we talked about it. I agree now. Dwight would be a nice bit of insurance. And if not him, maybe DeMarcus Cousins.
Yeah, somebody to give them a little bit of depth on that front line. Hopefully, I mean, look, Dwight Howard is not going to compensate for any potential long-term loss of Robert Williams. But in a conference where you are consistently going to see big physical teams from Milwaukee to Philadelphia to Miami, having a physical presence off the bench can't hurt, especially when that physical presence is coming in on a minimum contract and is someone like Dwight who has shown he's comfortable and willing to accept a lesser role. So, you know, I just think one way or the other, they should make a run at Dwight Howard, DeMarcus Cousins, somebody along those lines. All right. I want to talk about the recent reporting on the new collective bargaining agreement. The Athletic, the first to report that the NBA and the NBA Players Union are having substantive talks about a new collective bargaining agreement. That's good news for us, Howard, because neither one of us wants to cover a lockout or any type of labor strife. But among the things that came up in this Athletic report is something that we've been hearing about for many years now. The NBA is willing and, if not eager, to go back to the age 18 age minimum to allow high school graduating players once again to come in and to take off that kind of one and done scenario, take that off the board. But before we get into kind of when this could go into place and the impact it could have, like, you know, what's been your understanding over the years about why the NBA has made this pivot? Because getting scouts and executives out of high school gyms was something David Stern prioritized when he was commissioner. And even if the NBA didn't want to say it, treating college basketball like a minor league sort of worked for them. At least it did 10, 12 years ago, because you could get an extra sample size of 15, 20, maybe 30 games of a player that you could use to make your decision, so you wouldn't have quite so many, you know, prep to pro busts as there have been over the years. So what do you make of the NBA's willingness to go back to the high school age player coming to the NBA?
Yeah, so look, the prep to pro era was basically 95 to 2005, right? That's when Kevin Garnett starts this whole cascade, and then Kobe and T-Mac and Jermaine O'Neal all come behind him, Dwight Howard, and of course LeBron, the best prep to pro player of all time, if we're going to base it on who was the most ready on day one. And the door slams shut in 2006. And I always am quick to remind people of this, lest it be forgotten. When the age limit went into place in 2006 as part of the 2005 CBA, it's because, yes, the league wanted it. David Stern wanted it. He wanted scouts, as you said. That was his phrase. That was his quote. I want scouts out of high school gyms. These days, it would be junior high gyms and elementary school playgrounds. He had his reasons. And some of them, by the way, I think were valid at that moment. But I hasten to add this every time. The union agreed to it. This was not the NBA instituting this. This was not David Stern forcing this on anybody. It was brought to the table. The union agreed to it in exchange for millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars in compensation in the form of basketball-related income being guaranteed to them in that CBA. So the union signed off on it. And look, there was actual incentive for the union beyond the money. I mean, every 17-year-old that comes in or 18-year-old that comes in is knocking out a 37, 38-year-old at the other end, or possibly even a 34-year-old. So it's a finite number of roster spots in this league. So that they're open to changing it now, you could say it's David Stern to Adam Silver. Okay, maybe that's part of it. Billy Hunter is the one who signed off as executive director of the Players Association in 2005. Michelle Roberts comes in 2014, I think it was, saying, screw this, there should be no age limit. But she also said there should be no salary cap, no max salaries, no anything, basically. And within a couple of years after that, Michelle and Adam had both been new to their roles. Within a few years, Adam himself is saying, yeah, you know, I think we're moving in a direction where we should reevaluate this. And then eventually he's saying, yeah, we're probably ready to get rid of it, subject to negotiations. This has been on the table. It's funny because every time this comes up, it's breaking news. It's been on the table and kind of agreed to in principle-ish by the league for at least 5 years. But talks to do it as a side issue. Remember, a few years ago, we were talking about they're going to negotiate this outside of the parameters of a new CBA. They're just going to do it as a one-off. You can do that anytime you want. You can change the rules anytime you want. League and the union get together. They say, you know what? Let's change the rules on marijuana. Let's take it off the banned list. Let's change the rules on the age limit. Whatever it is, they can do that anytime. They don't have to wait. They did have discussions. Those discussions went nowhere because both sides were waiting for the other to give a concession as a trade-off because they're both thinking that the other side is now incentivized. It's a weird dance. I do think it will probably go away soon. And one of the reasons is the NBA now is a fully functioning minor league. The now G League, formerly the D League, formerly the NBA Development League. That makes it easier. Because to my point earlier about David Stern and his motives, part of it was that there were some flameouts, some spectacularly bad and alarming flameouts by some of these guys coming in too young. Corleone Young, Leon Smith, Robert Swift. And I don't think the league was ready to deal with it back then. But they are now. They do have a G League. They have, you know, I think, what are we at now? 29 teams. We still don't have 30 because who's the holdout? Portland, I think, was the holdout. If everybody's got a minor league team, if you draft the 17 or 18-year-old based on talent and not on actual readiness, because that's the consequence. Talent is not always readiness. And we saw that. And by the way, I'm sorry I'm rambling, even Kobe, Jermaine O'Neal, T-Mac, and Dwight, some of the best prep-to-pro players we ever saw, were not ready. Go back and look at their rookie seasons. Look at their rookie stats. Look at the clips. They weren't ready. And if you have a fully functioning minor league, if you've got better infrastructure to support these guys physically and every other way, then you've got a better chance of them succeeding at a higher rate, integrating better than you did the last time you had this influx.
Yeah. It's easy to see why the union is for this. The union is about creating generational wealth for its players. That doesn't come generally in the form of a first contract. They're looking to get these guys to the second contract, the third contract, yes, maybe the fourth contract, as early chronologically as they are in their lives. Like, so if you can get a guy to the NBA at age 18, that means a second contract comes at age 22 instead of 23. It's just, it creates more opportunities for players to get big money over the lifetime of their careers. I get what you're saying with the NBA, and it didn't have a fully functioning minor league. It didn't even have the G League Select team, which has added another layer to all this. I still don't know exactly. It still doesn't make a ton of sense to me why they'd be all for this, unless they're getting some kind of major concession back from the union in return, because I still think the same principles apply with college basketball. There's, you know, a player that looks great in high school. He goes to college basketball, plays at Duke or North Carolina for 1 year, and you're like, you know, maybe he's not a first round pick. Or, you know, more likely, maybe he would have been somebody you take in the lottery when he came out of high school. And now that he's gone a year in college, you say, all right, well, maybe he's not quite as good as we thought he was. And he goes late in the first round. Those things are still, they're still there for the NBA. There's still a positive to be taken from that for the NBA. And these young guys, like the G League is still, it's fine, but it is what it is. You're not getting great players outside of the select team to go play regularly in the G League. That's still not where it's at this point. Plus, my biggest, this is more a personal thing. You know, when the NBA went to the one and done rule, said you got to be over the age of 19 or whatever it is, I just felt like there would be a benefit that would never be seen. And what I mean by that is there could have been over the last 15, 16 years, some player, some high schooler that was like, you know what? I'm great. I'm Taj McDavid. I'm Corleone Young. I'm one of those guys. I am ready for the NBA, declares for the draft, and winds up like those players. Instead, maybe that player went to college and maybe he realized when he was in college that he wasn't an NBA player. And maybe he gained something from that. Maybe it's staying all 4 years at school. Maybe maybe there's some other trade-off there. Like, it's not something you can ever prove, right? Because you can't prove a negative. You can't prove something shitty was going to happen because you think it was going to happen. I just think that's a benefit of that one-and-done rule that doesn't get talked about enough. Like, the guys that... those guys that we talked about that, you know, with Corleone Young, if he had gone to college and played a couple of years at Kansas, would he have realized, like, maybe I'm not quite the same player? Taj McDavid, same thing. I mean, there's countless examples of guys that didn't make it going from prep to pro. I feel like that, we're going to have that happen again, Howard. When guys are jumped from high school, those guys we're talking about, those Corleone Youngs, the McDavids, Robert Swift's another example you used, Robert Swift, though, he was lottery, right? So he, at least he got some guaranteed money out of it. I think we're gonna see those examples once again, and I cringe somewhat at whenever that happens.
Yeah, and look, to be clear, and just to head off this counter argument, a guy can go to college for 1 year, declare for the draft, and still overestimate his talent and still end up dropping to the second round or going undrafted. Could still end up flaming out, could still end up not being able to handle the lifestyle or the business aspects. Like, all the things that befell the guys we've been talking about, Corleone Young, Leon Smith. Again, you know, folks, you go Google these guys, look them up, or go pick up my buddy Jonathan Abrams' book, Boys Among Men, which was a phenomenal book about the entire prep to pro era, tells all of the stories, good, bad, and otherwise. It can happen even if you went to school for a year or two and played at the college level. That's a given. But no one doubts that you are less mature physically, emotionally, mentally at 17 than 18, and certainly than at 19 or at 20. And that guys who have been dominating high school competition doesn't necessarily mean it translates when you're playing against men. And college is that interim step where scouts and GMs now get to see, well, how does this kid who was dominating in his small town against a bunch of guys he's a foot taller than, how's he look against guys who actually can match his athleticism or his skill or his height? That's actually important. Scouting kind of matters. Scouts get plenty wrong. They still screw up the draft. I love that aspect of it. There's no science ultimately to it, or there's an attempt at science, but it's still elusive. But having a bigger data set, having a data set of them playing against more developed young men in college, all that matters. And I think that's, you know, look, on the, if you're talking about what's good for the game, this is where I will defend it in principle. I won't defend it as a workers' rights issue, right? Like, it's indefensible when you talk about, like, you're preventing these guys from doing what they're best at and making a living off of it. Although, now that we have the G League Ignite, and we have Overtime Elite, and we have the Australian League, we have, like, there are places for guys to go if you don't want to go to college and if you don't want to go study something else to make a living. You can play basketball and make a living without the NBA. No one's entitled to just go straight to the NBA. So I do want to say that too. But I won't defend the age limit, generally speaking, in principle. I will defend it as what the league, I think, rightfully believed was better for it, or best for it, which is you want guys who arrive in the NBA to be ready for the NBA. And again, the success stories that people always talk about, Kobe, Dwight, Jermaine O'Neal, Tracy McGrady, eventually, yes, they were superstars, but it doesn't mean they were ready on day one. And when you're spending a high draft pick, when you are giving them that 5-year, you know, 3 to 5 year rookie guarantee, you're doing it because we think this is a difference maker. And so now that you, there's a higher risk in drafting a 17-year-old with the number one overall pick than in drafting a guy who's been in college showing you can play at that level against grown men for a couple of years. Like, that's the bottom line. And I think that part philosophically is defensible. And in terms of the quality of the game and the quality of the players that you're bringing in, that part of it made sense to me. Again, not justifying the rest of it, and I'm not advocating for them to keep the age limit. But I do think there was some rational and defensible underpinnings for it at the time that they brought it in.
Yeah, I agree. And it should be noted that regardless of when this new CBA is ratified, there likely is, and ESPN reported this, going to be a grace period for this. So it's not like in 2023 you're going to get an influx of high school players. Because draft picks have been traded based on the current model, there's going to be a several-year window where, you know, this will not be enacted instantaneously. It'll probably be 3, 4, maybe 5 years before high school players are before the floodgates open once again for high school players. All right, I want to move on to the Robert Sarver suspension. This was a topic, Howard, that we addressed briefly on the podcast last week. He had just been suspended for 1 year by the NBA, fined $10 million. Since then, the fallout has been significant. You've had players publicly pushing back, LeBron James, Chris Paul, notably a member of the Phoenix Suns roster. You've got the head of the Players Association saying Robert Sarver really has no business in a managerial role. You have got the co-owner, minority owner of the Phoenix Suns calling for the resignation of Robert Sarver. So your reaction to the Sarver fallout, and specifically, do you think it will have a tangible impact a year from now when Robert Sarver is eligible for reinstatement?
Last week, I closed my column about this issue by saying that maybe this isn't the end, this suspension, that maybe this is just the beginning of this all. And it was because of this, because we'd already started to see some of this come out. LeBron and Chris Paul and Tamika Tramaglio, the executive director of the Players Association, they were all on the record, I think, by the time, at least a couple of them, I think, were on the record by the time I wrote that. And it's because of that. So when people talk about Donald Sterling and Robert Sarver and why these cases were different, in part it's because of backlash that was swift and intense in the case of Sterling, and that did not come immediately with Sarver, even after the ESPN report last November. So it took 10 months to get to the stage where players and the Players Association are now saying he's got to go. And I'm not saying that they should have done that sooner. I'm not telling them to do anything. But I think had those demands come back in November, December, after Baxter Holmes' report came out, the league still would have said, we got to do our investigation, but there wasn't the groundswell that there is starting to be now and that there was in the case of Donald Sterling. And that in part matters. Like, the optics matter, the politics of it matter, the financial pressures matter, where the players are matters because they are more powerful than any other single entity aside from the 30 owners and the league office. So the players, if they want to push this, and depending on how hard they want to push this, they can make this very uncomfortable. PayPal, of course, has said it will not renew its sponsorship with the Suns if other corporate sponsors either start to pull away from the Suns and or the NBA in general. It might cause, I don't know where it will lead, right? Like, is that going to cause the Board of Governors to actually have a vote then? Probably not. Could it push Adam Silver to make the suspension longer, which was always, in his, one of his options? And there's no double jeopardy rules in the NBA that I'm aware of. I think he still could. But also it could increase the pressure on Robert Sarver to sell. And I think that's where this ultimately could go and where a lot of people are hoping it goes, is that some combination of financial pressure, political pressure, player pressure will get to the point where the league is leaning on Sarver, and maybe Sarver himself decides, you know what, this isn't worth the headache. And I'll say what I think I said last week on our pod, and I said it somewhere. If you're Robert Sarver, like, what are you, aside from pride, aside from ego, aside from just being stubborn and just digging in, what do you have to gain by sticking this out and showing up again in a year and having the world screaming at you and saying, you know, that you're unfit for this league, which he clearly is. He's going to make a boatload. He's already worth hundreds of millions. If he sells his share, he will make hundreds of millions. There's really no punishment in this, except that you're no longer get to walk around bragging that you are the majority owner of the Phoenix Suns. And I would think that in some more diplomatic way, the NBA, Adam Silver, would try to convey that to him. Like, look, this is not, it's not good for you to be the face of this team or a face of this league. That you should just gracefully, you know, disappear. And he could. And he'll still live a very, I don't want to say a happy life. I don't know. I don't want to presume his happiness. He will still live a very wealthy life, a very entitled life. So that seems like the best way out of this for all parties. But that requires Robert Sarver to voluntarily bow out.
Yeah. When I talk to people around the league about the situation, that's what comes up the most in the most hoped for outcome, that Robert Sarver decides that it's just either not worth it or not going to happen for him to come back a year from now and just reassume his position as the majority owner and man in charge of the Phoenix Suns. Look, the owners are not going to force Robert Sarver to sell. We both know that. Like, they're not. Like, because they don't want to set a precedent. They don't want to open a potential Pandora's box here. And to something we talked about last week, Howard, I'm not sure that Silver is going to extend the suspension because I don't think he wants a lawsuit and all that would come with a lawsuit, discovery and depositions and all sorts of stuff to kind of unearth some things the NBA doesn't want in the public eye. So I think this is all about Robert Sarver's appetite to be this uncomfortable, to be this reviled. You know, he's had his star player, you know, push back on him. He's had the head of the union push back on him. He's had his co-owner push back on him, the person running the operations for the next year while he is in suspension. So, if Robert Sarver doesn't give a damn, and if he says, look, I don't care if you hate me, I don't care, this is my team and I ain't selling it, he'll be back next summer as majority owner of this team. But you have to feel like of all the possible outcomes in the last week of what could happen, all the criticism, the public criticism, was probably what you'd be hoping for if you want to push Robert Sarver out. Because if it had been relatively quiet, if like Chris Paul had said, well, you know, look, he took his punishment, we'll all move on again in a year, this story probably would go away. But right now, it's still front and center, and I think it will continue to be into media day next week with the Suns, when they'll all be asked about it. And as we kind of inch closer, you know, there'll be stories about it, I'm sure, at the six-month mark of the suspension and into next year about whether or not it's even feasible for Robert Sarver to return.
So, you know, Draymond Green took to his podcast to talk about this and said Robert Sarver should be out. So he adds his voice as another star player, high-profile player to LeBron and Chris Paul. Tamika Tremaglio, when she went on ESPN, made it very clear that her tweets were not just her speaking as an individual who happens to be executive director of the Players Association, but she is speaking on behalf of the players when she says he should not be able to hold a position of authority anymore in this league. So this strongly suggests that whether it was by vote, whether it was by the player reps from each of the 30 teams, some way it was conveyed to Tamika that listen, this is where we are as the 450. The 450 players want him out. That's not a small thing. I also think that we're going to hear from a lot more players when media days start because they're all going to be asked. I think players should be asked in every market. If we're all doing our jobs right, players on every team in every market should be asked about the Sarver situation. This is not just a Phoenix Suns matter. This is an NBA matter, and all the players have a stake in this. So if we're doing our jobs right, everybody should be getting asked this in the media days that are coming up. On top of that, if you fast forward a year and Sarver is still around and visible, deciding to be visible, I think you could potentially have, or most likely will have, demonstrations outside of the Suns' home arena. You will have other actions. You know, Al Sharpton's not going away on this issue. He has released multiple statements. Others may follow suit. I think a lot of people are back to the waiting game of seeing, well, is anything else going to happen here before they really decide to bring all those forces to bear? But if Sarver's still in that position a year from now, I'd be shocked if there weren't demonstrations and more increased threats of economic boycotts and sponsors deciding to pull the plug. So, yeah, again, I wrote it last week. I'll say it again. I do think this is not the end. This is the beginning, and I'm very curious to see what happens next.
Yeah, well, we've got about a year to see how it all plays out, but the next wave of criticism is likely to come next week when we have media day.
And there's still plenty of time here. If you divested of at least several of your houses, you and I could pool our resources and possibly still make a bid for the Suns. So we should plan this out.
Will they take, I could probably do like $2,500 a month. Will they take installments? I could do that. I could pull that off at this point.
Do they take Venmo?
They should. I would like that. I still wouldn't be able to afford
more than because PayPal has severing its ties to the Suns. We cannot buy the Suns through PayPal.
PayPal wants out. All right, last thing for you, Howard. The Lakers. I think the Nets probably have the most fascinating media day. You'll be there next week for that. The Lakers, equally interesting. I'll be around LA for Lakers media day. And I'm very curious to see how the Lakers explain the Russell Westbrook, Dennis Schroeder, Patrick Beverley, fill in the blank, backcourt combination, how it's all going to work. Dennis Schroeder, the ex-Laker turned current Laker, signed to a new contract this past week. He joins Beverley and Westbrook in the backcourt. And look, the Lakers have done an admirable job communicating to preferred media members about how this is all going to work. it's like I'm reading like, Dennis Schroeder and Westbrook will compete for the starting job, or Schroeder's going to be a backup. Patrick Beverley, I read somewhere, is the Lakers view as a 3-and-D wing player.
He's a wing.
Okay. All right. It's still none of this makes any sense.
I'm waiting for them to say he's just the backup center. Like, if you're going to do this, let's get him as absurdist as possible. They view Pat Beverley as their backup 4-5 stretch big. Come on.
If you were going to give, the Lakers front office truth serum, you would probably get back that they want Patrick Beverley to be their starter on opening night because he brings the kind of defensive mindset that Darvin Ham is looking for. I mean, Darvin Ham spent portions of the summer talking about Westbrook being the defensive point of attack when the reality is Westbrook has not been an elite defender since like college. But Beverley fits more the role that Darvin Ham is looking for. And Dennis Schroeder, for all he's kind of gone through over the past year, still 28, 29 years old, a really good offensive point guard who can defend as well, multiple positions. You bring him off the bench in the same role he was kind of in Oklahoma City and a role he played at times in Los Angeles. LeBron tweeted out his excitement about having Schroeder back. Like, that's, he's not a bad backup point guard in that situation. But Westbrook there gums everything up. And I still can't believe that the Lakers believe, Darvin Ham, Rob Pelinka, all the front office members that have input there, I still can't believe they think having Westbrook around is the right move. They're not acting, Howard, like they are. Like, they're going out and getting Patrick Beverley. They're signing Dennis Schroeder. Everything they're doing is telling us, or at least telling me, that they're trying to build a team that doesn't include Russell Westbrook on the roster. Because with Westbrook, Beverley, and Schroeder, three guys that play maybe two positions, but it's still it's a weird mix to have two of those guys on the floor at the same time. I'm just hard-pressed to believe that this is what they want, to have all three guys on the roster come opening night.
Yeah. I mean, look, in a vacuum, Beverly's a good pickup because you could use the defense and the feistiness. And I like, almost any team that I would have expectations for, playoff expectations or high level playoff, deep playoff run type expectations, I would want Pat Beverley on that team. Like, I'd be happy to have him on my team if I'm trying to contend for something. Dennis Schroeder on the Lakers in particular, where I think they just needed somebody else who can do some things with the ball in his hands, who can create a little bit, score a little bit, take some of the pressure off LeBron, whatever. Like, those are both good pickups. And if their offseason had been picking up those two guys, but offloading Westbrook for whatever they could get for him, then I would see some balance in the roster. But right now, it's terribly out of balance. There is a glut there. LeBron is going to be your primary ball handler every moment that he's on the court, or nearly every moment. And those other three guys are going to all need the ball in their hands some, and we already know that Westbrook chafes when he doesn't. So I'm with you. To me, this telegraphs that we're preparing for life without Westbrook. We just don't know how we're going to get there. We wish we could have gotten this resolved by now. We didn't. But here are two guys who have played point guard-ish for most of their careers. One of whom is a defensive specialist. The other one is a good scorer off the bench. These are both needs we have. We'll worry about the Westbrook thing later. And that's it. Like, they're just kicking the can down the road a little bit. The can's already down the road. They didn't kick it there. The can's just permanently stuck ahead of them somewhere because they wanted to resolve this and they couldn't. You know, they will keep trying to pretend like this is what we want, but the whole league knows better. The whole league knows that it's really comes down to trying to find a deal that they could consider palatable and resigning themselves to the fact that they probably have to trade two future first round picks, which they really don't want to do. If Westbrook made a third of his salary, this would already be over by now. And that's the real issue. If there were any teams in the league that really, really wanted him, this would be over by now. But it's still sitting there. It is going to be the elephant in the room for the Lakers when you're there for media day and for every day beyond that until something happens.
Yeah, and the number of teams willing to do a deal with the Lakers, or at least that have the ability to do a deal with the Lakers, has dwindled by the week. Do I think Indiana would still do a deal involving Buddy Hield and Miles Turner in exchange for getting back those two first-round picks? I do believe they would do that because I think Indiana, just like Utah, is all in for Victor Wembanyama this year. I think that's who they want on their roster in 2023. And moving Hield and Turner, you know, that all but guarantees you're going to be in that mix for sure. San Antonio, could they do a deal for Westbrook that would bring back the two first-round picks? Probably as well. The Lakers seem to have decided that that's just too high a price to pay, that unless they're getting back, you know, talent that almost guarantees them a championship, they're not looking to do that at this point. Now, that appetite could absolutely change in the coming months, because if this team starts off like 500, you know, over the first 12 or 20 games of the season, the pressure is going to be ratcheted up to make a deal that improves this roster. If it looks like early on that Westbrook and Schroeder and Beverly don't fit, because right now that's what it looks like. I mean, we are not as smart as Darvin Ham. We are not as smart as Rob Pelinka when it comes to basketball. I get that. But, you know, we sat here last year and said, it doesn't look like Russell Westbrook's going to work on that roster. I have a fairly comparable feeling right now, Howard, with Westbrook and Beverly and Dennis Schroeder in that backcourt on this roster. I just don't feel like, it doesn't feel like it's the right fit. So if this team starts off slow, I would imagine you'd see the Lakers' appetite on trading away draft picks will change.
Two ifs there, right? One is, as you just laid out, if they start slow and they start feeling the heat of this team is underachieving and it's we've got this imbalanced roster, we've got this glut at point guard, we've got guys who can't figure out how to mesh all their skills. That's one factor. The other one is, how long does it take, assuming Westbrook starts opening night, how many games can they go struggling before Darvin Ham asks Westbrook to go to the bench and try to balance things that way? Energizing the second unit, clarify things on the first unit, giving Westbrook a role where he can still be the primary playmaker when he's on the court and with the ball in his hands, but not necessarily always with LeBron. And if that happens, then the clock is ticking on Westbrook's entire being, right? Because we know he's not going to be real keen on going to the bench and playing sixth man. So there's a couple of things at work there. And then the broader context for all of that is the Western Conference is, again, brutal and even more brutal than it was before. I mean, let's go through real quick guaranteed playoff teams, right? Assuming health, and I'm just going from the top of the standings from last season, right? Phoenix is in the playoffs. Memphis is still in the playoffs, although I think they're going to be slipping to outside of the top four. But Phoenix, Memphis, Warriors, Mavericks, Jazz are out. Denver rejuvenated with their guys back. Minnesota was already a playoff team and now has Rudy Gobert. The Pelicans made the playoff team through the play-in and now have Zion back and have a full season of CJ McCollum. We're at seven, and the Clippers, who I hadn't mentioned yet but who could win the West, that's eight. I've got eight teams. Now, you have the play-in tournament also, right? So it's really the six guaranteed and the four play-ins. But still, that's eight teams that I'm not sure the Lakers are necessarily better than. A full season of LeBron and Anthony Davis, I always give the benefit of the doubt, could possibly, everything clicks and they're a top four team again. Possible. I don't want to bet against LeBron and Anthony Davis as a twosome. But it's the rest of that roster around them. It's the uncertainty about Westbrook. It's all the other deficiencies that they still have as a roster. And I just named eight teams that feel like virtual locks for playoff / play-in. And on top of that, hey, look, I don't know how good Portland's going to be, but they're going to be better than they were with a full season of Dame and a couple pickups. I don't know how good the Kings are going to be, but I think they're going to be better with a full season of Sabonis and some pickups. Rockets and Thunder might even be better. I'm not putting them in play-in range. I'm just saying everybody's going to be a little bit better. So, like, the Lakers, you can't start slow in the West. Like, the only guaranteed crappy teams are the Spurs and the Jazz, who are trying to be crappy. After that, it's they're like, remember, we saw the Lakers like get trounced by the Thunder, like, wasn't it twice in 1 week?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's no easy path back to respectability for them.
No, it's going to be a challenge. And look, I'm sure when they convene for media day, they'll say all the right things. There'll be some moments in training camp, some video put up on the Lakers Instagram or social media feed of Westbrook and Beverly playing well together in the early practices. But it just, sometimes you got to trust what your eyes are showing you, man. Like, and you know, Westbrook didn't work last year. It wasn't about the number of games he, LeBron, and AD played together. That didn't have much, if anything, to do with it. And the idea that Westbrook and Beverly can play together in the same lineup, you know, Beverly's not a bad three-point shooter, but he's not some marksman out there. The idea that he and Schroeder will be successful as a twosome and an undersized back, none of it makes any sense, Howard. It doesn't, even for simple basketball minds such as ours. So,
to say nothing of whether Westbrook and Beverly really want to coexist, considering that they have a long history of hating each other. I mean, you know, as you know, I'm all about the anything can be overcome in the NBA. A lot of this stuff is a little overblown, or, you know what, if guys want to win, they'll figure it out, and, you know, whatever. But that's a pretty tangled history, those two. So, you know, anything short of seeing a video of them, you know, like, you know, I don't know, having a wine tasting together or whatever, you know, bringing their families together and having a picnic. I don't know what it's going to take for me to believe that those guys are actually okay with each other, but I'm a little skeptical even of the vibes of this team and those two in particular.
I am as well, but I'm sure it'll give us a lot to talk about, at least over the first few weeks and months of the regular season. Howard, we'll look forward to Monty McCutcheon on the podcast on Friday, and we'll do this again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.